Bong. I don't know what that was.
Did I hit the mic?
Did you hit the mic with the face?
Oh, when I went like this.
Pretty much. Bong. Welcome back to the Such Nerds podcast. I'm your host for tonight, Peter. This is episode 9 of season 4, and we are reading Foundation's Edge. I am joined tonight, as always, by my fantastic, beautiful, illustrious, handsome co-hosts.
Dan from Los Angeles.
And Jason from Florida.
I'm so glad to have you guys back this week. I think we have a very thirsty episode coming up tonight.
Thirsty Thursday.
For those of us who don't know, we always record on a Thursday night, and it get released question mark whenever
on a different on
whenever
a different
Jason
night.
Gets
on a separate night, right?
On another night.
So I'd just like to shout out some credit. We give Jason a lot of grief, but this thing would not exist without him. He's really the ringleader behind the scenes, even though I'm the one who talks.
Says the important things.
So this
Peter
week we read
the most. Peter says the most important things, and right. The audience appreciates that.
That's right.
But sometimes somebody has to be the glue that holds the whole thing together, and that's Jason.
Yes,
it's like the milk, right? It's the reason that you go to the grocery store, and then you get other things along the way, right? It's
right.
Like everybody shows up for Peter, but hopefully they get a few other things out of it along the way,
right?
Yeah, they show up for Peter, and then they're indoctrinated, and they never leave.
That's right.
That's the plan.
And then they get the vinegar that is Dan.
It's Kool-Aid. Just don't
the
ask
Kool-Aid, yes. I'm always selling.
Don't ask what's in it.
I can guarantee it's not cyanide. Anyway, so we read.
And if I'm lying, then you'll have to come find me later.
You'll never know. So we read. How are we pronouncing it? Is it Gaia or is
Gaia.
It Gaia?
It's Gaia.
I would pronounce it Gaia. But according to the book, it sounds like it's Gaia.
Not anymore.
Gaia and collision.
So according to the ancient Greek, it's actually Kea, like with a K.
I can't believe you. All right. Well, anyway, while we're debating semantics, Dan, why don't you go ahead and kick us off?
That may be on the Such Philosophers podcast. We can call it Kea, but this
actually,
is not Such Podcasts.
To be fair, if anyone's going to get hung on semantics, it should be the Such Nerd podcast.
Exactly. That's semantics. So something else, but I can't remember.
What I think is important to mention is that between the last episode and the current episode, I stumbled across where the word Gaia that they're using for this planet comes from. It's actually ancient Greek. And the meaning is primordial Mother Earth, one of the protagonos, the firstborn generation of Greek deities.
Yes.
And the contemporary scientific notion of the Earth as a self-regulating living being. Now, this book that I'm reading this from was definitely published after Foundation. I'm wondering if the idea of the modern scientific interpretation of Gaia as a self-regulating living being is a notion that came from Foundation.
I think it's an interesting idea, but I think it probably comes from the ancient Greek legend of like the Greek gods and whatnot.
I think it was, you know, the modern environmental movement, which was probably, they really founded it in, I think, the early 70s. And they've always referred to it that way, like it's essentially a living being. We're just jabbing in the eye repeatedly, time after time. And it will have its revenge one way or the other.
It's not nice to fool Mother Nature. But yeah, Gaia is an ancient concept, right? So Gaia and Uranus, or the sky god, gave birth to all of like the Titans and whatnot. Yeah, so that's like the first generation of the the ancient Greek gods. So I think the concept of Gaia being the primordial soup, essentially, or like the mother of everything, dates much, much further back.
The 1980.
Right.
I'm thinking like at least 1979, somewhere between the 60s and the 70s, you know, Peter.
I think like, it probably started around the same time as World War One.
Somewhere.
I wasn't there, so I don't actually know. But, you know, it's just a theory I have, right?
Like in the 60s.
Like,
that's what you mean, right?
I mean, I think World War One happened like around the birth of Christ, like around 0 AD. I'm not 100% though.
Wow. None of this is in my summary at all.
That's all right. We're getting off topic here. Dan, why don't you go ahead and kick off that summary for us?
Thanks, Peter. So we rejoin our friends Trevise and Pellerat on board the Far Star, chatting nervously while they wait for their visitor. They are surprised to find it is an attractive young woman named Bliss who accompanies them down to the Gaian surface. Bliss takes Trev and Pell to meet Dom, explaining that it is he who brought them to the planet. Dom tells of the collective nature of Gaia, its histories and myths, of robots and the mule, and ultimately of an impending crisis that Trevise is intended to solve. Meanwhile, Jendabal and Brano plan their approach to Gaia. After a quick discussion with Shandess, the new first speaker encounters Brano's ship and a conflict is narrowly avoided. The two foundations settle on an uneasy truce as they make their way towards the planet.
I wasn't sure it was going to be possible. These were some two intense chapters.
They were certainly very thirsty chapters.
Yeah.
And you managed to make them as dry as possible.
Magically, yeah, exactly. Those are the only sentences that we're allowed to use in that podcast because I had to edit out all the other words.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's get into that juicy bit now.
A lot of the back and forth locker room talk associated with...
That's a good way to describe it, Dan.
It's very interesting, you know, the whole, I mean, it certainly takes a turn. I was not expecting that at all. I mean, given Isimov's proclivities, maybe it makes sense, but I was not expecting, you know, that things to go that route. I had a lot of ideas about what could be coming down that tunnel, and, you know, that was not one of them. One of the things that I thought of throughout all the reading ahead allusions to it, I was like, okay,
that's, yeah, as I was reading it, we transition from like hypothetical political science, you know, sci-fi type plot line into all of a sudden I'm in Amazon women on the moon. And it's like, what just happened? It's like all about this, you know, this like pretty young girl who comes on the spaceship and they're just, you know, Pellerat's like fawning all over her. And
guy in high school girl
in something in that dork.
And it's like, it's a little bit of a distraction. I think he could have done it a little bit more subtly, maybe.
I think that was kind of the whole point, right? Is to kind of send a seductress up, kind of like disarm them, right? And then they bring these two goofs down to the planet and, you know, kind of teach them the way of things. Right. So Dom is the, I guess he's like kind of like the head administrator of the planet.
It's untotally clear what he's the one who.
And I don't know if he's one of many. I got the impression he was one of many, but he's kind of like the biggest one, right? It's like the highest.
Well, he has what, like 267 syllables in his name or something like that, right?
And it's read on his birthday.
Yes.
Like, which he finds rather embarrassing.
I got some big Treebeard vibes from the whole Dom character and like Lord of the Rings style, which is like just ant kind of slow moving. You know, kind of like elderly type of feel.
Like every older stoner I've ever met where he's like, so dude, this is what's going on. And like, almost like he met like an old aging architect, like, you know, more just like, oh yeah. Like we're all one with nature and
check out these cool shades that I designed. Put them on, man. It's super trippy.
Yeah. That was the other thing. Yeah.
Do you have any Kahlua?
Put on these super. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's very much a Jackie Treehorn production for sure.
I'm here to fix Dyna Cable.
Yeah, Yeah, it was a strange one, and then you never knew it was going to go, and then they just had like a what they walked in through his like beaded curtain and sat down in his room, and they had a little talk about you know, life and planet and where everything comes from and you know, who people are, and then he talked about your magic 3D glasses and the living wall that, you know,
so everybody's like, we're kind of like glazing over a lot of details, but essentially the people of Gaia have managed to hone their psychic abilities, so they're all in tune with each other, right? And so then they experience art in a different way, like they kind of see an older architect really kind of fits the bill for this guy, right? Because at one point they talks about like how, you know, you put on these goggles, right, and you look at this wall and it's perfectly a wall, right? Like it is the like pinnacle wall that you could have, and it's stably built and it's symmetrical and it does exactly what it's supposed to do, and you could like see the essence of its being better by having these goggles and being tuned into the Gaia life force energy psychic field, whatever you want to call it.
With that, Dan, with that, Peter, I thought of like an ANSYS analysis of stresses in a mechanical body, right? If you ever look at like a finite element analysis that's been computerized, they usually use like a color spectrum to represent low to high stress levels. And it looks like this kind of like ebbing and flowing. It's kind of trippy, to be honest. And it reminded me of that when he talked about it, like capturing the essence of the wall, like showing that the loads are all even. And it's like, another way to look at it could be like the crystalline structure of the materials was homogeneous and harmonious, and a stable wall is evenly distributed forces and the loads are well balanced and it will last forever. So it's a happy wall kind of thing.
And I definitely had the thought that Jason would love this. It's like Jason would love to experience the most perfect wall ever.
It's like my dream. Yes.
Mechanical engineering marvel.
Yes.
Wall is perfectly in harmony with itself.
Yeah. But before we even get there, to just take a step back, I know, Dan, you went through the summary, but the whole idea is like they find themselves trapped in this kind of almost like tractor beam vibe, right? Of their ship is getting drawn toward Gaia and they can't control it. And then they see this other ship approaching, you know, this beautiful seductrix walks onto their ship and
her name is Bliss. She has a name, Jason.
Her name is Bliss, which
her name is her part of her name is Bliss.
Part of her part, like, one syllable of her name is Bliss.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's like, it's mentioned how, you know, seductive she is, you know, presents herself when she arrives on their ship. But basically,
she's pretty obtuse when she shows up, actually. Like, she's like, I am Gaia. And you're like, what does that even mean, girl? Like, are you like a projection of Gaia? Like, are you possessed by Gaia? No, it's, and it kind of comes to light that she's like her own person, but she's just tied into this like neural net, so to speak.
And they introduce the idea of like, well, why are you on the satellite space station? And she's like, well, that's my stint. It's like almost like this, you know, utopian communist environment where people have their stint, right? That they do this thing for a little while and that's what they do. And then they come back and they do something else. And if they like it or if they're good at it, they kind of get, I guess, channeled towards a particular area of the ecosphere of this planet.
She's intentionally coy. And I feel like that's part of her flirtation and seduction, right? I'm not sure that I entirely trust these people.
No.
Right? Like, you don't send up your thirst trap to like hang out with two men that have done nothing but hang out with each other, in space for the last six months.
It's been a small ship for a long time.
Right, exactly. So. It smells like an old sock in there.
Yeah.
It
smells like chicken. You read it, he smells like chicken bits. He's like,
yeah,
he's like, they're hanging out, and he's like, we're just hanging out some chicken bits, and he's like literally like two men at the time.
You have to use your fingers. Like, yeah, he literally yells at him for using his
hands. Gross and disgusting, and meanwhile,
he's like, I can hear you breathing. Like, can you breathe slower? Like,
he's probably like, and she shows up. He's like, covered in chicken grease.
Right.
Wearing like probably the same clothes for the seventh day.
Yes, there's mustard on his shirt.
He's just like, no, sorry, my pants are always like this.
She, after Trevise points out to Pellerat that it stinks because he's eating something
chicken bits.
She, on when they get down to the planet, points out that the ship stunk to high heaven, and what could they do to air it out while it's on the ground? And I would just like to point out that Peter made this prediction early in the podcast season when he mentioned, these two guys are in this tiny little spacecraft flying out in the universe. Like, it's got a stink in there, you know, yeah. Like talking about eating yogurt and all kinds of other stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I can't be in a car with somebody for 4 hours.
Well, but I mean, at the same, he sort of alludes to it. He alludes to it early on when Pellerat is complaining about the ship smell. And then Teresa's, which I might have mixed up, but Teresa's like, well, you don't complain about the smell on a ship. Like, it's like not nice or whatever.
You don't complain about the air on somebody else's planet, is what he says.
Yeah. When they were on Seychelles, that they were kind of like, bitching.
I mean,
about,
like everybody, spoilers for all of our listeners, we all have children, right? And so we've all been in a car for like 4+ hours with a child at one point. And you're like, why did you bring a banana? Like the whole car smells like hot banana peel now. Yeah. Or like yogurt, really? Like, what? Could you choose a smellier food?
It's like,
you want to eat a tuna fish sandwich while you're in here?
Milk was a bad choice.
So they send up their thirst trap, right? And then they bring them back down to the planet, and they're like, oh yeah, look how harmonious we are, right? But yeah, this is like an isolationist society that all of a sudden like has decided that they need to like lure a first foundationer to their planet, right? It's like very weird.
But there's something about Trevise, right? It's not necessarily that he's a first foundationer. It's like him as an individual is a standout, right? That comes out.
Yeah.
Like, it's got to be you, right? It's when they talk about... The long and short of this whole adventure is when, you know, after they bring him down and they talk him up about how Gaia works, and, you know, Trevise is like really antsy, right, about what's the deal. So Dom is going through the history, and like, we should talk a little bit about like the Eternals and all this other kind of interesting things he brings up about robots. But the long and short of it is he basically puts Trevise in the spotlight, saying, you're our guy. Like, you're going to save us from destruction. First of all, like, he doesn't even like them. He doesn't know who they are. Pellerat seems to be empathetic to the guy in
Bliss. Well, he's definitely hooked on Bliss. He's highly empathetic. There's lots of flirting.
Yeah. He's trying to stay out of the friend zone. That's what
he's trying to be just dangerous enough that he's
being like, I'm gonna play a long game here. Pellerat's just like, oh, hubba, 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 hubba.
Like, let's just say he doesn't just like Bliss, he's kind of in like with Bliss, you know.
When she was in there, and the part where she like is not making the speech properly, she's screwing up the diphthongs, it's kind of sounds like she like is. I was like, this is an entirely, you know, simulation of a person. You know, it's like designed to have them be calm, and like it's like an alien with like a, you know, like with the skin on it. That's sort of right. If it was alien, it would freak out.
I was actually wondering if she was a robot when she first showed up. Right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, are you like an android?
Android
or
Yeah.
I'm sure in true Isaac Asimov fashion, we will find out in chapter 19 everything that's going on for reals. Right. And then chapter 20 will be kind of like this epilogue with like a secondary real ending, right? So I'll be like, and then they all live to happily ever after, except for the real truth comes out.
Yeah.
And it was Pellerat the whole time.
Yeah, you know? There's not a lot of runway left in the book. So it's kind of like,
there's only two chapters left.
We've got all our duos, right? We've still got Trevise and Pellerat, and we don't know, like, Pellerat seems to empathize with the Gaians, and Trevise seems to be their unsung hero of the future, but he's like, it's weird because he's not into it, you know? And then on the other two ships, we've got Dendabal and Novi.
Marlon Brando.
Right. And then we got Marlon Brando and Lion-O
from the
Thundercats.
Lion-O from the Thundercats.
So it's like, who's the puppet and who's the puppeteer? And, you know, what's really going on with these other features, right?
I have to confess that when I was reading Brano's like dialogue, I imagined it in the voice of Snarf.
Lion-O, we need to stop the second foundation, Snarf.
She's really got me confused because it's like a complete like bipolar
180
switch flip for her, right?
Yeah, it feels
she's like she's been out of control from her original persona that she presented. So she's just been this like sleeper megalomaniac, as she's called by Gendabal, right?
You know what she seems like? She seems like, what was his name? The doctor who had his brain overclocked by the mule. Like where he was
Ebling Miss?
Ebling Miss. So like when Miss like was like not eating and he was like manically like there's like a certain similar vibe that I'm getting there. But the question is, like, why would you want that, right? Why would you – because, all right, we've established that Gaia is, like, the planet that the mule came from, right? And somehow the mule broke off on his own, which was, I guess, against the law, whatever, went out on his own, and then he, like, conquered the whole universe, right? Or at least the whole foundation. So his motivation was – like, I still don't fully understand why the mule's motivation was that. But, and now, like, reframing it within the context of this book, is it that the goal of Gaia as a whole, like, is to somehow, like, nullify and conquer the first foundation as a whole? And then he just went rogue and was like, we're going to do it now. Okay. I'm going to go off on my own and we're going to make this thing happen. And that's what was, like, made it illegal, is the fact that it, like, kind of, you know, he was like too aggressive for the rest of the system, or he was like, I don't know, somehow like I think of him as like cancerous somehow.
So he was called a mutant and he called himself a mutant. And I think that, you know, I almost want to go back and look and see what the words were that were used around the mule's mutation, because while we were reading, right, the impression was that he was a mutant because he had these mind control powers. But as we're reading this book, it's more like the mutation was not the mind control powers. The mutation was the self-interest versus the common good of the Gaian cause, you know? So everybody that's on Gaia today is like, they're all brain powered up, right? Like they can manipulate and project and they're all connected to the Borg and all this kind of stuff, right? But the mule was, he applied it for his own benefit versus
the
planetary good.
I mean, if you believe the mule's own origin story that he kind of revealed, that he was like this horribly abused member of society, essentially, and then like he never wanted to go back to that world or have a world where something like that could happen again. Like, what? That doesn't, like, rampant abuse, if you take the Gaians at their word, doesn't seem to be like have a place in that
world.
I'll
tell you what, right? You know, like when I think of someplace like Gaia, it feels a lot like Japan. And in Japan, as they say, the nail that sticks out will get hammered down. So I think there's like a big, when you have a very homogeneous society, there's a big element of peer pressure that keeps everybody in check versus kind of like government tyranny or something like that. And I could very much, very easily see the mule being like, almost like, how can I say it? Like enlightened to enough to question, why are we all just marching to the beat of the guy in drum, if you will? And because he had the kind of doubt about that and considered what is the alternative, maybe he stuck out like a sore thumb. And then that ultimately led to his being ostracized from typical Guyan, you know, whatever goings ons, and deciding that he was going to peel off and do his own thing.
Yeah, that's probably what his great sin was, is that he removed himself and like now he harmed the entire collective because they have this quote unquote shared sense by leaving and going off somewhere else. Now, whether his superpower was just the ability, the collective mindset that he had because he was raised in the Guyan universe and was able to sort of just, you know, operate as a mind melder of a certain sort, because that's where he came from. And now everyone was like, well, look, this is what happens when you force that kind of know-how on the general populace. We can't have that happen. You know, I don't know if it was more that they were offended that he left them, you know, or like left the Borg, as it were.
He was called a criminal.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking the same thing. Thinking back to like when they found him, he was like on the beach of Kalgan or whatever, and you know, he just sort of, you know, how he ended up there, the you know, all these other things.
He already had his legend like built up around him at that point, right? Like in Kalgan.
Yeah, he was like whatever, a million feet tall. But that's just how people look at it, you know. When are they gonna like devour and eat these people?
How to cook humans?
Yeah, exactly. How to prepare? Yeah, how to say it? How to prepare humans?
I haven't been eating a lot of meat recently because it hasn't been available.
Yeah, it's just like, what? It's like, what is exactly, you know, what is exactly in store? But then it's like, well, you know, Chavis, you're the guy. We've been slowly coaxing you here through our whatever wiles and ways.
I mean, he does seem to have like a special mark almost, right?
So yeah.
He goes to the top of First Foundation politics, right? And Compor said that, you know, he should have recruited him for Second Foundation. Because he knew, but when he discovered him, it was in college, it was kind of too late. And now he's been marked by, you know, Gaia, or Third Foundation, as I like to refer to them, being like their savior somehow, right? And then there's like this kind of standoff that happens like out in space between First Foundation and Second Foundation, and then they both kind of come to the agreement that we need to like team up and figure out what's going on with Gaia. And somehow, I don't know, our boy Endoball can like break his way through the psychic, I don't know, network shield, whatever, of the
mentalic
Gaia shields. And the mentalic shields or mentalic shield of Gaia, and then I guess that it will enable the First Foundation to like blow the planet up. I don't really know, but it's, she's got this like super carrier on standby.
Yeah, so we just shifted, like, so in the first chapter of this week's discussion, Gaia, we have, you know, the introduction of the Pelerat and Trevis to Gaia, right, through this Bliss and this Dom character, right? Then in the next paragraph.
That Bliss
in the next chapter. In the next section. In the next chapter, collision. We have this standoff, space, right, between Gendebal and
Bronny Brando and Lionel.
Brasso Bondo, I think is their name.
Brasso Bondo.
Brandy Brown.
So, you know, in the standoff, it was hard to really.
Did you feel like it was tense?
It was like, again, it was almost expected Maximov. It was tense, but it was also like, here we go. There's
like,
put the counter put, and then the recount counter put, and the counter put counter. You know, it's like,
it's like listening to two 11-year-olds, like my children, argue over which fruit is better. Like, oh, I think strawberries are fantastic. Mangoes are disgusting. It's like, no, mangoes are fantastic. And I'm done. I'm just like,
I kind of had that 11-year-old feeling.
LARPers being like, well, I cast a Jasmine Expersion, and that's +5. I might, and well, I cast, da-da-da. I'm just like, all right,
and in
children.
The end, I like how he's like, she was like, what did she say? She said, well, you know, you've talked to me a lot, and then now you're promoting cooperation. Like, why do we have this huge conversation? Why didn't you just say that from the beginning? And he's like, well, you know, I thought I'd try to reason with you, but in the end, I'll just ask that we cooperate just the same. And it's just like, what the heck is that whole chapter about?
As a foundation, it's just reiterating the point. It's like, I don't like these people. They're like on each other. And I'm just like, I hope they both like blow each other
up. Right.
Exactly.
You just hate both of them so much. Just kill each other.
It's like, what's wrong with you people? All right. Novi is just like, Novi and Lionel are just like, let me shoot these two into space. You know, like, we just get on with this. It's like,
Novi's just like standing there, like, slack jawed.
But until the last sentence, when she says, no, master, up to this point, it didn't matter. But please, make no further move. We must wait for Councilman Trevise of Terminus. So,
which is funny because she doesn't even know his name, right?
It's like, is she in on the joke here?
Sure. Well, they talked about where they're going. So I'm sure she must have mentioned, like, Gendabal must have mentioned where they're going.
But why does she have such a clear, sober idea of like what must happen at this moment?
Because the whole time she's been, you know, she's the what is the right guidance phrase of it? Agent. She's been in the Eisenmovian tradition where it's, you know, like you think about the mule and how he was like this, you know, sort of forgettable,
unsuspecting
unsuspecting character the whole time. Then it's like, well, it turns out in the Eisenmovian fashion, it was somewhat of a Chekhov's gun where she's there and she's like, oh, she's so hopeless. It's like, well, what is she there for? Like, right. Clearly because she's going to be the one. Everyone else is talking about how awesome they are. Brando's got all these ships and, you know, Gendabal is the first speaker. And now she's just like this, you know, whatever.
I'm waiting for the shoe to drop on Lionel. Like, you know,
I am too, but I don't know if I'm like getting myself revved up for nothing because I've been holding out for him the whole book, and like all he can come up with
two
is
more
just
chapters.
Like, you know, following Brano into the
he does smoke a pipe.
Two
though,
more so. Chapters.
Oh yes, thank you, Dan. That is an absolute
thing. Of
I totally noticed the first tobacco of the book is Lino Cadell.
I got hot.
Well, that's packing how his pipe.
Real man.
Back in the pipe.
Right.
He's a real man. He's got his elder beard.
Lord knows what. I don't know if Seychellian tobacco is as good as a vegan tobacco. You know, I don't know if he just brought it way back when or if they picked it up. And that's why I was like, yeah, thanks, Mr. Man, I can get behind.
Finally.
Clowns even smoke. I know.
Finally.
Not afraid.
Thundercat. Always a big fan of Thundercats.
I like pipe. I like my women smooth-brained, and I like my men smoking. So they're the only two characters. I'm like, what's going to – like, these people didn't really do anything wrong. They're both going to get blown out of the sky.
Right.
Like, and I just – it's – I read through it, and I'm just like, I don't like any of these people.
I mean, other than the unspeakable horrors that Lion-O clearly committed in the name of the First Foundation as secret police.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's the Gestapo.
Yeah, he's definitely like pulling out fingernails.
Yeah, the East German Stasi is Cadell, you know.
Talk
in serve of Brian.
Where is the Second Foundation?
Yeah,
you'll tell me what I want you to tell me.
Yes,
I think it would be really nice if, in the end, that you know everybody dies except Lino and Novi, and you know they. look into each other's eyes and just, you know, ride off into the sunset together and live happily ever after. I think that would be a nice ending of this novel.
I have a real hard spot for Bliss.
Soft spot.
Yeah, soft spot.
It was a hard spot, and then it softened up.
Now you're making it soft.
But yeah, I mean, as she likes to say, it seems like she's on board with it, because even she goes down and...
Oh, yeah, she like giggles on at
Pelletier's. Yeah, what's his face? Well, Dom is like, oh, you look fantastic in that, you know, you ravish these aged eyes. And she says, it is for your ravishment that I put on this blouse. And then she says, Pell is above such thing, and Treb dislikes them, which I thought was kind of interesting. It's like, Pell didn't strike me as above any of that. He was, you know, right down.
Well, and that's what he interjects immediately. He's like, oh, no.
He's like, I may surprise you someday.
I think that's gentle.
What a delightful surprise that would be.
She's like doing that coy flirty thing, right? Yeah. That's what that is. But I mean, can you imagine being like a real nerd reading this like back in the 80s?
As I say, even dignified elderly men are overcome with boyish ardor.
I think, you know, it's worth mentioning that there are a lot of interesting Isimovianisms to pick on here through these two chapters. Aside from his obvious, you know, lecherous bent of the Gaia chapter, I can't devote the rest of my life to dancing this conversational minuet with you both.
But you could.
It's like totally unnecessary embellishment.
Right. I feel like that's a hallmark of Isimov's writing.
Well, the other one, it's
like,
the other one.
He was like, oh, okay, I like this word in the thesaurus. I'm going to use that.
Exactly. You're just breaking them out. Well, the other one, it's like these aside things. It's like, oh, Harlebrander smiled grimly, her lined face setting more deeply into its fleshy crags. Oh, that's very lovely, Isimov. Setting the scene. Brano,
those old women.
Not 23.
Yeah,
clearly not wearing a sheer blouse. Hopefully not wearing a sheer blouse.
Knows how she, and, knows how she got a grim on that
grim that fleshy crags.
Yeah, but he also makes it a point, like, it's not enough that she's like indistinguishable from a man, but to send the message to Gendibal, her voice gets converted to a flat tone in a man's voice. Like, that's how it gets sent over to Gendibal's, you know, vessel or whatever, right? It was like, why was that necessary? Like, what is the what is the value in adding that embellishment to the communication?
Early Radio Shack technology for the marketing tie-in. Yeah, it's, you know, never misses a chance to throw some shade at some woman.
I just imagine that they're always talking in transatlantic accents all the time. Now, you listen here, son. This is Commodore Brano for the First Foundation.
But we do have a lot of reveals. Like, we get a reveal about the whole Compor situation, right? Where she talks to Lino about giving him the ship with the marginal controls, and seeing that he was able to follow Trevise anyway, which she wasn't worried about finding Trevise because he would have stuck out like a sore thumb wherever in the galaxy he went. But she sent Compor to try to find out if dude is Second Foundation. And so she gave him the crappy computer, and it turns out that even with the crappy computer, he still was able to make it happen. So he must be Second Foundation.
Wasn't it even tampered with? I thought the computer wasn't just like worse. It was just like, it was actively made defective.
It was like marginally defective, like enough that you could get it to do some things, but generally it wouldn't do all the things that you wanted to as smoothly as the one that they gave.
They put Windows 8 on it.
Windows, what was it? Vista?
Yeah,
Windows Vista.
Yeah.
So, and then
Windows number 2, as they call it.
And you know, she's also telling like Codell that I don't tell you everything that I do. And she's like got these scout ships. There's a lot of holes in the chain of events that is pretty funny. She talks about having a scout ship that watched the exchange of Compor and Gendabal on the spacecrafts. And I'm thinking, like, where is this scout ship watching these two dudes like change vessels that Gendabal has no idea that somebody else is watching him? So that seemed like a kind of an interesting, you know, like, oh, that's,
plot hole.
You know, seems a little unbelievable based on what you've told us so far. And there's a few others as well. That's like when Trevise and Pellerat are looking out and they see the spaceship coming at them. And it's like, how far away do you think it is? He's like, well, without the computer, there's absolutely no way to ever figure that out, ever.
No, like, no, no. It could like, be a really tiny spaceship that's actually super close to us. It's like, small microscopic like man.
It could be a microscopic spaceship, 1 millimeter from the ship. Large
spaceship that's thousands of miles away.
Like, I guess out in space, it's hard to like reference things.
Use the binoculars backwards. What are you doing?
They've mastered space travel. They can figure out how far something is away, right? And how big it is.
Is it? Oh, I don't know. Hold on. Let me take out my string and just trace the arc on my four-dimensional viewer.
Has Isimov like essentially like M. Night Shyamalan himself, where it's like you're just waiting
the corner.
You're like just waiting for the twist, and you're like, oh, okay, there it is. Like,
yeah, nobody's gonna be the twist. What she's gonna do, I don't know.
I mean, I don't know that she's gonna be the twist. I think she's just a vessel, maybe at this point, for Gaia, like to be like a conduit to which they communicate. I don't know what's gonna happen with Brianna. I feel like her brain's gonna explode. Like,
I mean, I just think it's that everybody else's intention, I guess with the exception of maybe Codell, everybody else's intention is like clearly stated about what they're trying to do. And except for Novi, who's kind of just has played no part other than sort of being along for the ride. And
I mean, she wants to be like, a scholar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I feel like the same could be said true of like Lionel.
That's what I said. Aside from Codell, for being he's the other weak person that, you know, it's he's not. He's there purportedly supporting, you know, Brano, but yeah, it could be him too. But, yeah, you know, it just seems like in the Isimovian history, those are the ones who you got to keep your eyes on. It's the quiet ones you got to watch out for.
Yeah, if Codell's like some kind of sleeper, then I definitely get the Prescience Award this year or this season.
Well, it's a good thing you're awarding it to yourself. So,
right.
You know, right. You know, is the ballots so are in out, and I wrote all of them.
I'm victorious. Like, the further it goes and the less he plays like a critical role, the less hopeful I am that I have any chance.
At least the less prescience you're gonna have. You never know. And I haven't read ahead, so.
But I do think Suranovi, like we talked early on about Suranovi being suspicious, right? Like Gendabal couldn't recognize that she was there. All of a sudden, she's like in his face and he didn't even see her coming. Like, that seems very suspicious. And now she's been with him the whole time and she knows all the information he knows. And he's been, you know, admiring her brain. And now she's got this like slight indication of this metallic field that no other brain could recognize. It's just like a lot of suspicious, you know, mentions of her in throughout the book.
Well, especially considering we never really knew what the, you know, third foundation per se, what they are and how they manifest themselves. You know, it's sort of a first foundation is obvious what they are. We said that second foundation, they've sort of shown their hands. Third foundation, whoever this mysterious force is, it's not, you know, you'd figure, oh, it's just another all powerful force, but mm-hmm. Who the heck knows? It could be anything, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think those are our two Novi in the Foundation ship with the candlestick or whatever.
Right.
It's the clue.
Exactly.
It's the clue victory.
The mastermind behind it all.
I don't know. We'll see.
I don't know, man. There's just a lot of
going back way to the beginning. I guess, you know, Codell was sort of in the beginning.
She has a very suspicious comment.
Novi?
Or there's a very suspicious comment, not from Novi, but if you remember early on, she talked about word chopping. Do you remember that?
No.
And she used the phrase word chopping with Gendibal, and I think she was referring to like talking too much or something. I don't know what it was. But when they met with Dom,
yeah, he used it.
He used the word logic chopping. So I'm like a little suspicious that there's some kind of a tie with, you know, this idea of using this kind of phraseology. I don't know if it's just Isimovian tendency and the, you know, an element of the times, but to tie Dom's euphemisms with Suri's euphemisms.
I follow the same thing because it's like, if you think back to where she, it's like, play that forward, right? So she's a guy in sort of sleeper agent or whatever. The Haymitch have been sitting on that planet, like in the woods as clueless morons, you know, when the Second Foundation just sort of clearly thinks that they're, you know, underlings who are not to be dealt with or whatever. Meanwhile, they could be there, you know, sort of like as, you know, spies for the Gaians. And then you follow it through and the circumstances which sent Gendibal sort of on his way are entirely because of that, her and them. And, you know, there's that point too, where it's like, if you've played it forward and she was one of those people, then she sort of set some of the whole things in motion. And if it's a tireless giant plot of the Gaians, then that makes sense then too.
But why would you deliberately bait the Second Foundation to you, knowing that the First Foundation might follow, right? Unless there's like some kind of...
Unless you're hoping they wipe each other out or whatever. I don't know. I'm not sure what the plan is. I'm just like thinking in terms of like broad strokes about where we got to now and thinking back to the beginning and which one of these things that...
I mean, I think you're both on to something, right? Like, I think that there's a definite possibility that Novi is like some kind of Gaian agent, right? And also the concept of the chopping and whatnot, that's an interesting clue, right? And Asimov is pretty good about his, like, the way that he uses words for his characters seems to be like consistent. So for there to be like
shadowing, yeah.
Right. So for there to be like that kind of hint that was dropped and then have like something that's kind of like lateral of that hint, like in the same family tree of logic, like that seems like there might be something there.
Like the mule having a one syllable name. Kind of thing. The mule is a Gaian, right?
Okay.
And he chose a one syllable name, Mule.
Mule. Okay.
As opposed to a 9,000 syllable name, like everybody else.
Right. Well, I was like his middle name. So.
My middle name is Mule.
I would have gotten with Quaker because I was born on a Wednesday. So.
Yeah. You know what else I noticed? We have another mention of biographer or biography.
Is it Isaac Asimov's fifth biography?
No, but he talks about the when Dom like recites his entire name for them when they arrive. And he's like, it's also kind of a biography, man, you know.
I kind of envision him also sometimes like a Gandalfian type figure.
Right. You know,
like old wizened beard smoking on his big bike.
Doesn't look a day over 75 though, apparently. Yeah. Apparently.
And how old is he? He's like 100?
He's like 90 something.
The Gaian is neither late nor early. He arrives precisely when he intends to.
Like, there's actually a lot of interesting points that caught my attention along the way. We talked about the very in passing, the kind of AR lenses that Isimov invented. Apparently Dom is good at crafting these special lenses that allow you to look at things and see their essence. And all I could think of was like Google Glass or some kind of AR system that augments what you see with additional information or something like that. So that
it's got to be hooked up to the Psi network.
Kind of foresightful. Yeah. The Psi network. They're called participations.
So, Jason, do you have any more last-minute details you want to add to our podcast before I put you to bed?
I do. Isimov invented Zoom calls with video option.
Did he really?
He did, because listen, when Quindor is woken up by Gendibal with the mind connection, he asks him if he wants to do visual or not. And all I could think of was like people going on video on Zoom and then realizing that they're the only one and then going off video right away. So we keep it just pure audio.
It doesn't make any point about that you need like two-factor authentication or like right. need both sides to be like, right, oh yeah, right. I'll take that call. You're just like, I'm just going to be peering into your house now. Like,
there's two other things that kind of stood out for me. One was this discussion about the Eternals. I thought it was kind of interesting that the Gaians, they trace their roots back to pre-galactic era, and they were actually, taught by the robots who developed this kind of mind connection capability. And these robots also developed an interdimensional capability where they could kind of see all the potential universea across the potential futures for humanity. And they selected one path that was like the most likely to retain the kind of healthy perpetuation of the human species or something like that.
Almost like a golden path.
I was about to say, was that like a golden path?
Exactly. It's the golden path, the yellow brick road for the humans.
Jason, I just have to correct you. I think it's pronounced universes.
I'm sorry about that.
Universes.
Okay. Universities.
University. The universals.
So the Eternals developed the universals. For the
universities.
In any case, it was a very interesting concept, but I think he's like plugging for his other book that is about the Eternals, called The Eternals or something like that.
Maybe.
That's so unlike Asimov.
Very Asimovian.
Talking off about his own book.
But after all that, when we jump to, so that's on the Gaia chapter, right? And then when we jump to the exchange between Gendibal and Brano, I just kept like shaking my head. I was reading the whole thing. They're going on and on, and like Gendibal's like, in 500 years, no one had ever thought to develop a mathematical formula. Like, these are the math geniuses of psychohistory who can mathematically predict 1,000 years worth of history. And they can't develop the formula for the power of their primary, force of existence, yeah, which is the mental wave or whatever.
They were too busy with all the intrigue that was required to keep the second foundation going.
Ridiculous. Like, why is Asimov spinning this yarn? This is like so...
It's hard to write lines for Brandon.
Writing books is hard, guys.
Writing books is hard. And it's harder when you're stupid, right?
I guess. I mean, like,
life is hard, and it's harder when you're stupid.
Is the writing of the characters bad, or is it just the characters bad themselves, or is it just a good character that's written by a bad character?
Exactly. He turns, and from Brano's perspective, she's talking about this mental static device. He's like, for 100 years, engineers developed the mental static device, and nobody understands it, but it works. We think, it's like, what are you talking about? It's 100 years of empirical development of some system
120
that
years.
Manipulates brainwaves, and nobody can explain it. This is absurd.
And yet somehow the robots have mastered it.
But they did, they developed the psychometer. And because they developed the psychometer nobody can explain either, that the mental static device works, because they can measure it with the psychometer don't understand.
In true Asimovian fashion, they can't. The only way they can learn about it is by observing some other person doing it rather than doing it. Like, I read a summary.
I tried to like give it like a little bit of like, I tried to take a step back and say, okay, is Asimov saying that somehow the first foundation has kind of overcome the second foundation wiping the mental static knowledge from people's brains when they originally employed it and they wanted it to be discontinued, but they somehow worked around it because they were able to kind of empirically perpetuate this technology or something. I don't know, but it's like, he could have said something along those lines. He didn't have to make up this crazy.
It didn't make any sense. I highlighted it because it made no sense.
Like,
the development of, let me read the section just so you get the context. The development of the Mentallic Shield had occupied Foundation scientists for 120 years in the most secret of all scientific projects, except perhaps for Harry Seldon's lone development of psychohistorical analysis. Five generations of human beings have labored in the gradual improvement of a device backed by no satisfactory theory.
I mean, that checks out.
120
right?
years, and we have no idea what we're doing. There's no theory.
They don't have a unified
theory. There's no even hypothesis.
Like, after the third generation of engineers work on it, you think somebody would be like, this
what are we doing?
Is trash. Like, why am I wasting my life away?
You still have no idea? Your grandfather has no idea? Your grandson is not going to have any idea? Like, what are we doing? Talking about acetism. It's like acetism in the guise of idiocy. I was like, oh, it makes sense. It's a great project. Then I read this line. I'm like, but backed by no theory. And they got the psychometer. And then they talk about all this, and they said, well, Brando says if we can get that, then they'll be good with the second foundation in mind control. But that was for the future. Oh, then it's five more generations in the future where we'll actually know what we're supposed to be doing here.
And we'll get there because we don't understand it. Like, that's how I know for sure we'll figure it out.
Tremendous amount of faith. Like,
just general, you know.
It feels like this last chapter... Like Isaac realized how many plot holes he had.
Yeah, he's just kind of like,
he's like, all right.
He's trying to like plug these holes, and it's like, yeah, it's just not the sense. Words are just he's not.
Ran out of fingers just, to stick in the jam.
I'm just waiting, reading things. I'm like, come on, buddy, wrap it up, buddy.
Exactly. And then in the same chapter that he talks about not being able to, you know, understand the power dissipation over distance of the mental field and having a conversation with Quindor back on Trantor, and it's like an instantaneous conversation. Then he talks about how Gendabal's mental waves travel to the First Foundation ship at the speed of light. And I'm thinking, his conversation with Quindor would have taken like 3 years.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it's like at least it would have taken more. It could have taken five lifetimes.
Hyperspace jumps for his conversation.
Is he like circumventing these light years of distance between the planets? Like,
Gravitics, man. It's Gravitics.
Just like, I was just so disenchanted with he totally blew his cover on the hard sci-fi side of this story. Like, he should have just kept it a magical thing and just not talked about it and not tried to explain it in detail and left it alone, you know?
That's what you get for reading all the words, Jason.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm just like, sorry, but all right, we're done here, Isimov. Would you get back to your...
Let's get to the human drama part of the story.
Clearly somebody has no... backed by no scientific theory is taking it to a logical conclusion. And speaking of things with no scientific theory, we have our instantaneous light speed conversation from 100 light years away. It was super light speed. No, not that light.
Other didn't even bother to make something.
Light speed means just really fast. Yeah. So my light speed walkie talkie.
Yeah. Like, oh, it travels through subspace, and that's something we kind of understand. Yeah,
it's wormholes.
Right.
It's wormholes.
Like, it's just not even an attempt.
It's gravitics. It's got a machine for
it's
that.
It's gravitics, girl.
And they also kind of like, this was also kind of a throwback for me to the Onum Bar chat at the end of Foundation and Empire, when he talks about, like, well, if they had been strong, then this would have happened. If they hadn't been strong, then this would have happened. So either way, they would have been, you know, overcome by the fate of the Seldon plan.
Oh my god, if they Seldon plan us, I'm gonna be so mad.
And that's kind of like, oh. But that's kind of like what they're doing.
Seldon,
right?
Pops out like the Crypt Keeper suit, like, ooh, I'm 30 years old.
Well, you must totally survive.
Tales from the Foundation.
Yes, Tales from the Foundation. But that's what they're doing. They're like, they're going through that exchange right now on the ship, like, well, if you blow me out of the sky, right, and then you'll get a galactic empire, but then it won't hold because there'll be dissent among the non-foundation loving worlds. And then it's like, if you do, then you'll have to, you know, increase the power of your military might, and then you're generals will become too powerful and they descent, and it's like you're just like running her down these trails. It's like all these like, horrible outcomes,
like verbal risk with it's like, but yeah, it's a throwback. I didn't even catch it, but yeah, it's just like the part where, you know, that's what,
yeah,
what are we doing it because we're doing it, or we're doing it because somebody else wants us to do it, and, you know, are we really acting, or am I acting just, or am I reacting, and is somebody else sort of controlling the horizontal and the vertical? And the answer is probably going to be yes, because it always is. Selden.
I'm hoping that this thing concludes in a satisfactory way. Maybe,
well, I don't like
maybe either, in a though. Fire explosion.
I know. Every book is with me. I'm nervous at the end here.
Right. You're like, I don't know how I'm going to do it. Oh, that was pretty good. Like,
yeah. I mean, it got frantic. So. I remember getting frantic at the end of the first Foundation, you know, when, you know, the mule finally landed on the planet and then business picked up super quick. And then it was, you know, super exciting at the very end with the various five-way.
Well, that was the second one, right?
Foundation Empire. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
When second half of the second book. That's when Peter's interest was peaked.
Well,
and started getting good.
That's when I actually. That's when my interest started.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've sufficiently beaten this Foundation to death. So.
Yeah, it came out a year after God Emperor.
Sure.
We went over this at one point.
And God Emperor, like with Peter, I know you love God Emperor. It's like your favorite.
It's my favorite Dune.
Favorite one out of the whole series. And it's a fantastic, you know, book. And if that didn't win an award and this doesn't end better than it's headed right now, like, I'll be very disappointed. The whole Hugo franchise. The whole Hugo franchise will be called into question in my mind.
Maybe I know nothing about this. It's just like, oh, the Hugo Award. Sounds fantastic.
All right, guys, I have been your host for tonight, Peter, along with my upsettingly energetic co-hosts.
Dan from 3 hours earlier in Los Angeles.
And Second Wind Jason from Florida.
And we will see you guys next week. Looking forward to the finale and finding out what happens. Hopefully it's everything ends in a fiery ball. Everybody have a great night. See you next week.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Bye.